This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We know our daily lives add carbon relentlessly to the atmosphere. And I know this isn't what anybody wants to talk about, but what if millions of helpless people die because we won't change? Michael T. Clare says we may bear the guilt of climate genocide. Clare is a longstanding professor of peace and world security studies at four New England colleges and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. In 2008, I interviewed him for his book Rising Powers, Shrinking World. He's the defense correspondent for The Nation magazine, often posts on Tom's Dispatch and Salon magazine. His latest there carries the headline, Climate Change as Genocide, but the international response is essentially a shrug of indifference. Michael Clare, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
A pleasure to be with you today.
Michael, what spurred you to write this uncomfortable article about climate genocide?
I've been seeing signs of or reading about the famine now underway in three countries in Africa and in Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula. I read that 20 million people are at risk at dying now at this very moment, over a million of them young children, because they lack access to adequate supplies of food and water. The UN is trying to save these people and has the tools to save them, and yet the international community is doing nothing to provide the UN with the necessary funds to go forward. They're just turning their backs on these starving, unfortunate people. And this is bad enough. We should be ashamed of ourselves, the international community writ large. But I fear that this is a sign of what climate change will look like, where the numbers will be much greater, and that is the numbers of people facing starvation will be much greater, and a large number of us in the more affluent countries will be doing whatever it takes to preserve our way of life and ignoring those who are suffering. So that's what prompted me.
Well, this isn't an inconvenient truth, as Al Gore talked about. This is a horrible truth. Do we really have to think about this right now? We've got other problems.
Of course. I want to raise it because I think that people who care about the environment and climate, and there are many, many of those around the world. I know so many in my own town, Northampton, Massachusetts, a town of 30,000. There are hundreds of thousands of us who are protesting all the time about the climate. So I know there's an awareness of climate change and the environment. What I fear is that people don't grasp the nature of its impact. We worry about eroding seashores. We worry about burning forests, about endangered species. All of these things are good and proper things to worry about. I fear that we don't grasp the fact that the biggest victims of climate change are going to be human societies. And by the nature of things, and this is very clearly reflected in the scientific literature, and I hope you'll ask me about that, by the nature of things, those who will suffer the most and the earliest will be poor people in the developing world, and poor people in the developed world, for that matter, indigenous people, very poor people, people of color. But on a world scale, it's going to be poor and disadvantaged people in the developing world who will suffer the first, who are suffering now from climate change, and will suffer the most. And this is clearly demonstrated by the scientific literature.
Well, you've opened that can. Let's have a look. What does the scientific literature predict will happen and where?
The scientific literature is very clear that areas closer to the equator, by and large, and the Arctic, or the two poles, will suffer the most. fortunately, not so many people who live in that. Nobody lives, very many people live in the Antarctica, and not too many people live in the polar, North Polar region. Those who live there are already facing very severe consequences of climate change. Their villages are melting away. The permafrost is melting. That's demonstrable. The species they depend on are dying off. So their lives are already at risk, and mainly those are indigenous peoples. So that's clearly demonstrable in the scientific literature. But fortunately, the numbers in the polar regions are few. But the most severe impact of climate change is going to occur in the equatorial regions, the tropics and the subtropical areas, because this is where you have large populations that depend on rain-fed agriculture to survive. And the rain is going to disappear in many of these areas, and with it, water is going to disappear, and the ability to produce food is going to disappear, and the crops are going to wither in the increasingly higher temperatures. So some numbers of billions of people whose livelihood depends on agriculture, they're already facing extreme stress. And you look towards the middle of this century, and some of vast areas of agriculture are going to collapse. Now, we know what the consequences of that are. Hungry, miserable people are going to migrate to the cities, and they're desperately going to try to get into Europe or wherever they can, and conflict will ensue.
Well, your article sort of twigged me to another point, which is that these people that we're talking about are depending on rain-fed agriculture. I was thinking about the California drought, and California was able to keep going because they have the dams and all the profits of decades of fossil fuel development to keep them going. But these, you know, where the rain doesn't come, people die.
Absolutely. Or in sad cases, they fight. They fight over what little water there is. And that's proving to be the case in large swaths of Africa, in the area known as the Sahel, the southern fringe of the Sahara Desert. This is in places like Mali and Chad and Ethiopia and Sudan. In one country after the other, you have intense conflicts underway that are typically described as ethnic conflicts because typically it involves clashes between Arabic herders, pastoralists, and other groups, Christian groups who are farmers. And the lands that the herders depend on is being desertified. Now, before our eyes, the Sahara is growing every year by miles and pushing the herders further south into the land occupied by Christian farmers or traditional Africans, and producing clashes all across the African continent.
I have to say my first reaction to your article in Salon was that I really didn't want to talk to you about it because I kept coming up with objections that would make it not my fault that all this is happening. And I think right-wing radio listeners must be saying, well, why didn't you count population? I mean, the population in all four of those countries that you wrote about have quadrupled since 1960. I mean, if they can't control their population, why is it our fault?
Now, first of all, let me clarify. You used the word guilt early in your introduction, and I'm uncomfortable with that word. First of all, the guilt, I believe, falls on those who are perpetuating the fossil fuel era at a time when we know that its effects are going to be devastating and lethal. So many of your listeners, I'm sure, are doing whatever they can to reduce their fossil fuel consumption. And what I said in my article is that inaction equals extinction, annihilation. It's those who are perpetuating this system who I think are guilty, not those who are active in the struggle to slow it down and to reverse its effects. So the question is, what efforts are people taking on their own behalf? And population is not responsible for climate change. What's responsible for climate change? Overwhelming percentage of it, more than 70%, is the consumption of fossil fuels. And sheep herders in Africa do not contribute 1 gram of fossil fuels from the consumption of fossil fuels to global warming. So they're not responsible.
And it seems like reading the United Nations reports, herding big numbers of people into camps for aid can be another bridge to mass deaths, but this time by disease. What happens there?
This is an old story, and it's a human story that we know from the Dark Ages, from the Black Death period in Europe, when many people are confined in close spaces with improper sanitation, and disease comes, and you have a breakdown of the health system, and people have malnutrition to begin with, it's easy for diseases to spread. But, as I note, and what the scientific literature shows, is that climate change is going to make disease, epidemic diseases, much, much worse, because a lot of the disease vectors, like the mosquito in particular, love hot, moist weather, and that's what we're going to get from climate change. Their range is going to grow. So, like the Zika epidemic is not going to be confined to traditional tropical areas, because we're going to become the tropics far to the north as a result of climate change.
That's so true. And you write, too, another key point that refugees from collapsing social systems and dying ecosystems, they get hit again when they move towards urban centers, especially near the seacoast. Could you talk to us about that?
Yes. This is something that I learned from reading the reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. They note that one of their big worries is that more and more people in the developing world, in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and the Caribbean, are moving from the interior of their country because they can't farm anymore because it's too hot and dry, and they're moving to the cities. And for the most part, the cities in these countries, think of Lagos, Jakarta, Manila, are on the coast, right on the coast. That's because that's where the trade lines are, the sea lanes, the airports, the globalization, all of that's where they hope there might be jobs for them. There are no jobs in the interior, so they flock to the coasts. But that's where climate change in the form of sea level rise is going to be most devastating. A lot of those cities in the developing world are at sea level, and they're going to be wiped out in the next 50, 100 years as sea level rises. And what's typical in all of these cities, so the literature shows, is that the wealthier you are, the higher up you are, the further from the areas that are most at risk, for the most part. And it's poor people who live in the floodplains and in areas that are regularly flooded, because those are the less desirable areas. So all these people moving from the interior can't afford to live in the upper-class residential areas, and they build shanty towns in the floodplains. And these are the areas that are going to be wiped out.
In an article published March 27th in the New York Times, reporter Jeffrey Gettleman writes, after Somalia's last famine, the multi-billion-dollar aid industry thought it had come up with an answer to prevent the next one, resilience. It was the new buzzword in aid circles, bandied about at workshops and among high-powered officials, end quote. I wonder if that hip Western concept can really work when we're starting from the ground up in so many countries.
I think this remains to be seen. There are many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, working with farmers and cooperatives in the developing world in Africa to try to develop sustainable agriculture where water is scarce, to switch from water-intensive crops to less demanding crops, to adjust. I think a lot of these projects show promise. They need much more investment than they're getting. They need more government backing and infrastructure assistance. So it's possible. But the bottom line is that the international community is not putting the kind of money into this to make it possible.
You are involved with Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Michael T. Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Amherst, Massachusetts. We're talking about our ugly role for mass climate-induced deaths of the world's poorest people. And Michael, I'd like to return to the central thrust of your recent article in Salon on climate genocide, but to get there, I want to take a detour through your expertise on peace, which you've taught to a couple of generations in New England. Do you think America is at risk of entering another major war?
I worry very much that we're in a new period where a major war is possible again. This is not something we've thought about in recent years. When we think about war today, for the most part, we're thinking about small wars, localized wars, counterinsurgency wars, counterterrorism, what we see in and civil wars, what we see in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And we've lost any memory. My students certainly don't have any memory of the Cold War period when war between great powers involving nuclear weapons was considered a real possibility. That memory is now gone. But I fear that we're entering a period in which those kind of wars are a very real possibility and can start almost momentarily. We have forces poised in the South China Sea, in the Korean Peninsula, in Europe, in the Baltic region, poised on very high alert for a possible clash that could escalate very rapidly into a big war. And I think as a result, we have to reanimate the kind of peace movement that you had during the Cold War period. That's going to be a tough slog.
Well, I think war will come, but not necessarily because of Trump's misjudgment or the too many military men in the new administration. It may come from below. I'm thinking in America, one-third of men 18 to 31 are living in their parents' homes. Many are not working or going to school. When they wake up from video gaming, they're shut out of the dream of consumerism. And that sounds like the kind of material we need to make a so-called popular war. What do you think?
I know people worry about that a great deal. I don't worry about it really the way you say. Maybe I should worry about it some more. I think there's some concern about that. I think any young man in America who wants to get a job can find one. They may have to move. There's a tragedy there. What's happening in places like West Virginia and Wyoming and the Dakotas is that young people who have any ambition are moving to the coasts or to Chicago where there are jobs and high-paying jobs for talented young people, abandoning the cities and the hinterland. And there is a sadness to that. But I don't see what you're talking about. What I worry about is the flashpoints where you have a rising China confronting an America in decline, where you have Russia trying to flex its muscles and NATO worried about its decline and one side or the other making a miscalculation. So I worry about muscle flexing and miscalculation leading to war.
I've been looking at lectures about the Crimean War, the Civil War, World War I, and I kept asking myself, why do millions of healthy young men want to throw their lives away in mass suicide? And for me, that cycles back to the whole question of mass deaths as the climate becomes more uninhabitable. Maybe that same hysteria for mass death is operating right now, helping to empower climate denial and inaction. What do you think?
Oh, my gosh. I don't think I can't speak to North Korean soldiers because they have been indoctrinated since birth into an extreme form of nationalism around a personality cult, and their thinking may be different. I don't think young men and women in uniform in the United States or Russia or China have that kind of death wish. I really do not think that. I think they have a naive belief, and that's what worries me, is the naivete that their leaders are sane enough to avoid accidental clash from escalating. It's the leadership lack that I worry about, that our leaders are not capable of managing a crisis when one arises.
Well, given what you've done and written about peace, do you think there's a role to start talking about climate peace?
Yes, I think that's right. I really do. I think that, personally, I believe the biggest obstacle to progress on climate change is going to be new Cold Warism, because the revival of the Cold War, which we're seeing before our eyes, and this preceded the election of Donald Trump, by the way, and I think would be underway even if Hillary Clinton was president. I think we would have this creeping Cold Warism between the U.S. and Russia. I think that atmosphere, and with China, and with North Korea,
and Canada,
and Canada, thus revival of, well, I call it Cold Warism, of hostility, suspicion, cyber warfare now added to the mix, show of force, muscle flexing, is going to create an international environment in which progress on climate change will become increasingly difficult. And that's what worries me. So if you care about climate change, which I know my students do passionately, they cannot avoid the war and peace equation.
So honestly, if we don't take meaningful climate action, and we're not right now, how bad do you think mass deaths will get and how soon? Is a great die-off possible?
I believe that we will see a planet which will be, which will witness a lot of misery and suffering and unnecessary death.
Do you cringe a little inside when you work through what that really means?
I do. I don't think I'm saying anything unique or original here. I think anybody who picks up the reports of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or any of the scientific literature and reads it through, which I've done, and puts two and two together, you know, the two is that the climate is going to make food production increasingly difficult in large parts of the world. That's the two, and the first two, and the second two is that people will not be able to feed themselves in large numbers, and two and two equals four is there's going to be large-scale starvation. I think that's inescapable from what we're seeing before our eyes.
Well, here's the conundrum for me, and it's that the climate threat could help generate a lot of other difficult problems to the point where people demand a strong man, they demand a military government, and yet it seems so evident that only a real, actual functioning democracy could save us from climate change. What are your thoughts?
I think this is the right question to ask, and I hope people struggle with this and take your question very seriously. I think there will be some effort by the super rich to protect themselves and their families and their servants from the effects of climate change. You know, you can read now about how the super rich are buying homes in New Zealand and buying citizenship in New Zealand, for example. Another favored destination in this literature, I hate to say it for you, is British Columbia. You know, people looking on the future weather maps to figure out where climate change will have the least destructive effect and buying shelters there and building walled shelters to keep out all of the rest of us who are going to perish or suffer. So I do worry about that. And that's why I think a strong democracy is essential to make sure that all humans have an equal right of survival in a climate-changed world.
What do you tell your college students about all this? Are they ready to hear about climate genocide?
I try not to give it to them in a big scoop all at once, to dole it out.
All right. And what are you working on next?
I'm working on a book on climate change, conflict, and American national security, trying to make the point that, and seeing this from a perspective of military and intelligence and security officials, that climate change poses a threat to global stability, and you can't wall yourself off from that. It will prove devastating to our civilizations.
We've been talking with author and teacher Michael T. Clare. He's the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies in Amherst, Massachusetts. Michael, I know this is a busy time for you, so thank you for spending some time with us.
It's a pleasure to having the conversation. Good questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.